This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martoreno. For the next hour, we hope you can spend some time with us because what we do is discuss the disease of addiction and hopefully the road to recovery. I mention this very often here on the program. There's certainly an abundance of news about the opioid addiction in this country and drug abuse and alcohol abuse in general. That news is often very, very grim for a lot of very valid reasons. There's another story, though, and that has to do with people who manage to work their way through this with a lot of help. There are millions of people living in long-term successful sobriety. And every so often on Recovery Radio, we like to bring you one of those stories, one of those firsthand accounts of what the disease of addiction was like and the path to recovery. So it's in that spirit that we welcome today's guest, Fran Pfeffer, to Recovery Radio. Hi, Fran. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate it.
No, our pleasure. We really appreciate people who are willing to candidly discuss this issue. There's great power in hearing stories of successful sobriety. Fran is 48 years old, and she is days away from your third anniversary?
Goodness, I don't even know the date today. It's August 29th. I'll have 3 years.
There you go.
So three years sober.
So very close to 3 years sobriety. Tell us about yourself. Where are you from? What was your family like? You know, that stuff.
Middle class family. You know, I was the middle child of an older brother, younger sister. Brother was 4 years older. Sister was 4 years younger. My parents didn't drink at all. They've been married 50 some years and they're still together and alive. And, I have a close relationship with my brother and sister. And just, you know, grew up regular middle class family. Parents didn't drink. My mom's parents were alcoholics. So she, definitely had issues with that. But when I was three, I guess this is very important. I was playing with a balloon and a balloon snapped in my eye and I'm left blind in my left eye because of that. And, that has kind of shaped who I am today because I have had 6 or 10 surgeries on my eye and, you know, don't really have a lot of room in my life for bullying and teasing and such because, my childhood was kind of hard with those kinds of issues with kids. But anyway, other than that, you know, other than being blind in one eye, you know, normal childhood, dad worked hard, mom had a daycare center, you know, graduated from the city schools and, you know, nothing too, wrong.
Yeah. Well, of course, the face of this disease it can be found in all kinds of families. So we certainly understand that. So tell us about your experience with drugs and alcohol. When did you start experimenting with drugs and alcohol?
The first time I experienced with any drugs or alcohol, I believe I was about 12 years old. And ironically, I was at the Taylor with my brother. Like I said, it was 4 years older than me. And we smoked pot together in one of the rooms and it didn't really do anything for me. I didn't really feel anything from it. And that was it. And then a couple years later, it was the first time I went out with friends and had, wild turkey of all things for my first time and went out with friends, drank. And once the chaser was gone, I was the only one in the group that continued to drink. And then after that, I drank every single weekend as often as I could.
When did the so there's that youthful, your brother turned you onto a little pot and then you discover alcohol. How old were you when you had that drink, the first drink?
14
years old. So you're and by the way, you're doing what a lot of 14 year olds do. You're experimenting with the, you know, the liquor cabinet.
Exactly.
But how soon after that first drink did you notice that it was a bit more than just, oh, let's see what this is like?
I'm sorry, how soon?
Yeah, how long after the drink, the first drink, did you begin to notice that this was more than just experimenting with some alcohol?
I loved it. I absolutely
from the first drink.
From the first drink, and it tasted horrible, and it was disgusting, and I mean, I shivered every time I took a drink, but it was absolutely amazing the way it made me feel.
Yeah,
there was a calming that went on in me that I wanted to have over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's amazing when the person who has the disease that doesn't know they have it experiences that first effect of whatever they're, you know, using, and how the two things come together so so naturally. But when you say it had a calming effect, or you loved it immediately, you liked the way it made you feel, what was your feeling prior to that? Were you an anxious person? Were you uptight?
Steve, I wasn't anxious. I mean, I think I was always a pretty outgoing person, and I often think back to that when I think about how good, air quotes, alcohol made me feel. I think back to, well, Franny, you know, when you worked, you weren't drinking and people liked you and got along with you. And so I often think back to that. What was I like without alcohol? I was still outgoing and friendly and kind, but I always felt less than. Always.
I'm sorry, you also felt what?
I always felt less than.
Yeah, less than. Okay.
Less than. You know, like I said, I grew up with this, I hate to call it a disability because it doesn't feel like a disability, but it is. So I grew up with this disability, this funky eye, and I was always waiting for somebody to accept me or, you know, make fun of me because of this. And there was no gray area. It was black or white.
Yeah.
You liked me and you were my friend, or you were mean to me. And so I was part of a decent crowd, not the most popular crowd, but I was always so insecure, always had a terrible self-esteem.
The alcohol made that go away.
Absolutely. As soon as I had that alcohol, you know, I'm sure you've heard it 1,000 times. I was the funniest person in the room, the prettiest person. I had no fears. I would try things that I wouldn't normally try. I would say things I wouldn't normally say. It was liberating. It was liberating to finally not feel less than.
Yeah. Yes. For people who don't know what that feeling is like, not being comfortable in your own skin is a very difficult thing, right?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting about what you described, the effect of alcohol on you. It's kind of supposed to be a funny joke, but the social drinker is likely to say something like, I drink to make other people more interesting.
Yeah.
And the problem drinker is always doing it the other way.
Exactly.
I love other people, but I don't fit with them, so I drink to make me better.
Yep, exactly.
The problem is, and we've heard this very often with regard to the disease model, it turns out that among the things you are allergic to are alcohol. You can't drink alcohol, but you don't know it until you're in the bottle, right?
Never. Yeah, I mean, I had no idea that...
Yeah.
So, I was an alcoholic. I had no idea that I didn't know everyone didn't feel that way. I thought everyone felt that way when they drank. And no wonder, you know, but my friends didn't do it in every single weekend. If we only had a six pack and they drank three, I always wanted three more. I always needed an hour more time out before I had to go home. Everyone else is just content till next time.
Yeah. Did your friends ever comment upon that to you? Like, you know, Franny?
Not when I was young, Steve. Like, I mean, when we were weekend warriors, like, you know, 16 years old, hanging out in the alley, asking the, you know, 27-year-old or 50-year-old man to get us beer outside Hildy's in Lancaster. Like, no one ever said anything then. It was only when I got older that it became apparent that I was one of those people that could not drink without what we called a wingman. You know, and as everything progressed that we'll talk about later, you know, then it was, I needed more than a wingman.
Describe, what's the wingman do for someone like in the throes of addiction? What's their role?
Well, then what it was you make sure I got home okay, make sure I didn't leave with strangers, make sure that I didn't, you know, crack my head on the bathroom floor in the bar. You know, it was literally babysit me.
Right.
That's what they did, Steve. They babysat me.
Yeah, yeah.
Babysat a 21-year-old or a 30-year-old woman or whatever that could not be left to her own devices once she put alcohol in her system.
Yeah,
you
so
know?
You,
but
yeah.
I didn't want to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, so that drinking to excess, how long a period of time did that last?
Like I said, weekend warrior from the time I was 14 until I went to college, you know, got myself into some trouble at college. And by trouble, I mean like with a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't like me drinking and blacking out.
Yeah.
Well, geez. And then it continued for... I had my children when I was like 23, so it continued for 8 to 10 years. When I had my children at 22 and 24, I mean, I was able to not drink during my pregnancies. Like, it wasn't that bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't drink during my pregnancies. But then as life hit me and things happened, then drinking, you know, as the disease progressed, as we go on, it got to the point where I would drink and drive with them in the car and that sort of thing. So it went on. When I finally stopped, the first time I went to rehab, I was 35 years old, I believe. So it was a good 20 years of...
drinking to excess.
Drinking to excess, yes, exactly.
And then putting your family's safety at risk. How did you... how did you justify that? For somebody who doesn't understand this, they're going, how could a woman get in a car impaired with her kids? How did you justify that in your mind?
Then?
Yes.
I know. I'm just thinking. Then I didn't justify it. Well, yeah, I guess I didn't think when I drank. So, and it's, I mean, I knew it was wrong and I knew I was scaring my kids, but I couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. And my kids wouldn't tell me not to, until, like, you know, we'd have a near miss with almost hitting someone or something. I've had cops pull me over, you know, I've missed trains, like terrible things have happened. I don't know how I justified it. I just couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. I couldn't not drink, and if I had to drive, then I had to drive.
Fran Pfeffer is our guest. She's telling us about her struggles with substance abuse and now her 3 years of sobriety. We have more with Fran. Stay with us. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Hi, welcome back to Recovery Radio. Our guest this week is Fran Pfeffer. Fran is 48 years old. She's a mother of two. Is that what she said? It was right, Fran? Mother two. And she's now 3 years sober, talking about her struggles with first alcohol, and we'll find out what else transpires here. But so, Fran, you mentioned that the behavior became more and more problematic, more dangerous. You're driving impaired. The kids are noticing it. You're running up against some legal problems. I want to explore some of the consequences of the abuse that you became immediately aware of. For instance, what was your husband thinking during all this?
Oh, my husband was a mess. It was my second marriage at this time, and I had gotten a DUI in 2001. So I got in a DUI, and, you know, it was a slap on the wrist, 4 months, no license. I simply decided the way to solve that was to, you know, just not drink and drive, drink at home. And then when I continued to drink at home and then drive with the children, my husband, who I had only been with maybe 6 months, started to notice it, and he wasn't having it. He was, you know, cleaning up my messes, taking care of me, taking care of my kids, hiding things from my kids. And we would come home and, you know, we'd check the car because I had been in an accident and the car would be dented or something. So he was done. After my second DUI, I ended up in the hospital. Luckily, I didn't hurt anyone else, but I ended up hitting a mailbox, driving in a blackout, and ended up in the hospital almost dying. And then he's like, that's it. You know, I'm not doing this anymore. You have to go to rehab. Mm-hmm. And both of my children were there when I woke up and said, yes, mama, please go to rehab. You need help.
Yeah. Was that a residential treatment program you went through at that point?
It was.
Yeah.
Yes,
so did you have, were you detoxed as well?
Yes.
And at that
No.
Oh, you weren't?
I apologize. Mm-hmm. I actually was sober when I went in there. I had about a week sober when I went in there.
Okay. And at that point, your problem was essentially just alcohol, or were you abusing anything else?
Correct. It was just alcohol. The first time I went into treatment, I had never, you know, really tried anything else. And I had one stint with coke after my DUI, ironically, that lasted 3 days, but I never went back to it again. I knew that I would not come out of that one in a good way.
Now, when your husband finally stops enabling, which is basically what goes on there, and tells you to you got to get into rehab. Do you remember mm-hmm. whether you were trying to save your marriage or your life, or what was your motivation?
Just getting him off my back.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's just getting him off my back, Steve. My parents were scared. You know, every time the phone rang, they thought it was going to be someone telling them I was in an accident or dead or dying. And I just wanted everyone to get off my back. And I had no idea what I was in for when I went into treatment. No idea.
You were there because you felt you had to go, just as you say, to calm everything down. What, you know, it's been suggested that alcohol is a little different. It's easier to hide because, after all, it's legal and it's a social thing. And from what I understand, it can be even easier for women to hide this. Now, you certainly weren't hiding it from your immediate family, but what about your circle of friends? Were they aware you had a problem?
As an adult, they knew that, again, that when I drank, I needed a wingman, that, Franny, only do 2 shots, like, don't do any more, or only drink beer, only drink wine, like that whole thing. They didn't understand. They, you know, had no idea how it was, and I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how bad it was. So, I mean, and yes, to answer your question, I was hiding it from them. When I got with my current husband, now I've been with 12 years, when I got with him and he, you know, came, we all lived together, I was coaching my daughter's soccer team, a U10 soccer team, and my alcoholism had progressed to the point where I would drink 2 bottles of wine before going to coach my daughter's soccer game at 10 o'clock, or pardon me, at 7 o'clock in the evening. And yes, I was hiding it. Nobody knew that. Mm-hmm. I had it pegged down where I could do it, coach these girls, and get home, and no one would know.
So what happened at rehab? So obviously, you're there in the wrong frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
How long after you came out of that treatment program were you able to maintain sobriety?
After I came out that first time, I was only able to maintain not even 10 days. Like, I couldn't maintain more than 10 days. I would try to do 90-90. I would relapse. I loved rehab. It taught me a lot about addiction, and I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I loved when they read certain things from the big book. I finally felt like there was an answer to why I was the way I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't work the steps. I didn't do anything I was supposed to do. I didn't get a sponsor. And I couldn't live with myself. Like, I still didn't know how to live. Alcohol was not my problem. It was my solution to everything. And when I got out of rehab, it was still my solution to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know how to deal with anything.
Yeah, yeah. Can you just, I know it's very difficult, but when you say your problem was everything, when someone who doesn't understand that you have a disease says to you, why do you do this? Why are you behaving like this? Did you have difficulty explaining what it is you couldn't handle?
Yes, I did. My husband never got it. My family to this day, Steve, I still don't think they get it. Like, my dad asked me after my first time in rehab, and he went to the counseling sessions, and he loves me more than anything, but he still doesn't understand it. And, well, couldn't you just have one beer mm-hmm. if they make your headaches feel better? And I'm like, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been a chronic headache sufferer, but yeah, they don't get it because they don't understand how broken we feel as addicts and alcoholics, and the guilt and shame that I lived in. Like, everything I had ever done, every time I had ever driven with my kids or been that drunk mother or coached that soccer team drunk, I was sitting in so much guilt and shame that I couldn't not drink
yeah.
because I was such a terrible human being.
Fran Pfeffer is our guest. She's talking about her struggles with alcohol and how she manages now to remain sober 3 years and counting. We have more with Fran. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Don't go away.
Radio.com. Radio.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you, our guest on the telephone, Fran Pfeffer. We'll be right back with us, but I want to just remind you about the sponsor of this program. That's Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. These people are known far and wide. They are among the best in their field. I want to give you their phone number, and you can check it out for yourself. These are great people. They know what they're talking about, and they're here to help. But they want you to have the phone number for any questions or comments you might have about things you hear here or questions that you have regarding the disease of addiction, whether it's affecting you or somebody in your family. And again, we hope you don't have to use the number, but it really could save somebody's life in a pinch. 855-859-8808, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Center. 855-859-8808. Fran Pfeffer, let's pick up your story again now. So, you know, you go into this first attempt at a treatment and it doesn't work. You relapse. How'd you feel when you relapsed?
Oh, horrible. Horrible. You keep trying to get that feeling like, oh my gosh, I just want to feel better. Like, I just want to feel like that. Oh, that perfect buzz, you know, and every time I cracked open a beer or, you know, drank, it just never ended. It always ended poorly, always. Like, I would have two or three beers and would turn into 12 beers and my husband would be mad at me, or I'd decide to go for ice cream and I'd drive again when I didn't want to drive when I was drinking. Like, I tried to control it and I couldn't control it anymore.
It's a full-time job too. If you're drinking 12 beers during the day, you got to hide cans and you got to do all, right?
Oh, and go buy extra cases and hide the extra cases and keep the amount right in the refrigerator. Yes, it was literally insane. It was insane.
How long did that, so the first treatment stint did not take? How long?
I did manage to get about 15 months sober. And then I ended up having, finally, like after jail, I mean, I drank in jail. I was on work release from prison and actually got drunk and went back to prison drunk. My daughter got taken away from me. She's 21 now and is actually home visiting me right now. We have a great relationship. But she decided during all of this chaos to go live with her dad in Michigan. She went and lived with him. So I lost my daughter. I drank while I was in jail. And I finally got 15 months sober, good sobriety, but I never worked the fourth step. And I ended up on Mother's Day, I was suffering the consequences of my second DUI, and a friend of mine drove me up to Michigan to visit my girls for Mother's Day. I ended up hurting my knee the night before and having surgery. And after surgery, 2 months later, I was addicted to pills.
Back up a second. What were the circumstances of your incarceration? Why were you in jail?
My second DUI. I got my second DUI. I had a 0.38 blood alcohol level. And then that's when I went into rehab the first time. And then that summer, I went to jail on my birthday, 6/13/17. Mm-hmm. And went into jail for 62 days. He took off my rehab time, the judge, and then I got 90 days house arrest, 90 days intensive probation, 5 years probation for my second DUI. And well, I had an Intoxalock in my car for 18 months.
Well, that's certainly not someplace a middle-class suburban housewife expects to find herself, correct?
No, it was horrible. I mean, I'm grateful that I was on work release. My job at the time was so wonderful. They loved me and, you know, believed in me. So they, you know, and they tried to help me. So they told the jail that, you know, I worked 6 days a week from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m, which I didn't. I had a 8-to-5 banker's job. And so I got out of there a lot. The only day I had to stay in prison was Sunday. Mm-hmm. But it was a long day. It was mm-hmm. a long 62 days and, I didn't even learn then. I drank and went back to jail drunk one day on a Saturday, and I can't even imagine what consequences I would have faced if I would have been caught.
How do you wind up going to retreat? What are the circumstances when you say, I got to get back into treatment?
I mentioned that I had surgery on my knee, and then for about I had a year of good stuff, good recovery. And then I started, you know, sneaking and calling my doctor for pills. And I got hooked on this pill roller coaster. I got migraines all the time. I was getting shots of Demerol. It got to the point, Steve, where I was in such denial about what was going on. I literally got kicked out of 3 doctor's offices for, you know, the first thing you do when you go in there is, did you drive yourself? No, I did not. Okay, here's a shot of Demerol. I knew exactly what to say and how to say it and where to park to get those shots of Demerol. And I did have a headache. But I also knew you weren't supposed to drive on them. And I knew, like, I couldn't find a sponsor to sponsor me while I was getting these shots of Demerol. So I just fired all my sponsors. And I ended up riding this roller coaster and finally buying pills on the street. And my drug dealer looked at me one day and said, I cannot give you any more pills. You're going to kill yourself.
Wow. It's another extraordinary aspect of this disease that while it renders you sort of null and void in every other area of your life, it continues to make you able to abuse the alcohol. You're getting better at doing that.
Oh yeah.
rather than worse at doing that. So tell me about the moment when you go, nope, can't do it anymore, got to get back into treatment.
I ended up you know, things had gotten rough. You know, like I said, life hits you, and we had gone through a custody battle for my husband's one daughter, and she ended up saying she wanted to live with her mom anyway. So I kind of went off the deep end, took a bunch of Xanax, followed by a bunch of non-narcotic drugs, but apparently they still make you very drunk. And I called a friend of mine after falling down the steps and said, I can't do this anymore. My husband was over it, Steve. My husband did not want me to go to rehab. He said, you know what to do. You've been there. Get to a meeting. You know, I'm not doing this again. We need you to work. You need to get your stuff together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I called this friend of mine, and he flew in from Myrtle Beach to talk to me and my husband. And he looked my husband in the eye and said, if you don't send her to treatment, you're going to be planning her funeral.
Was this friend also in recovery?
He is.
Yeah.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. The number of people I talk to, when I ask them about the moment when they make a decision, mm-hmm. they all have been lucky enough to have that person to call.
Oh, yeah.
So
literally a godsend.
So you went to retreat, right?
Yes, I went to retreat.
How did you get yourself there physically? They come get you? Did you drive yourself there? What happened?
No, I actually ended up ODing, and it was the day that Jerry was supposed to pick me up and take me to rehab. And believe it or not, I'm a foster mother as well in the midst of all this. And my foster daughter called him and said, you know, Franny's phone is locked. She's passed out on the bathroom floor. You know, you really need to come get her. So he was on his way, and he came over and he got me. And instead of going right to the treat, we went to the ER because, as he likes to say, we needed to make a pit stop first. And then from the ER, I went to the retreat and checked in. I don't have any recollection of doing that, but we checked into the retreat, and then I spent the next 37 days there.
Once your head clears and you're in treatment now, you're at the retreat. What are your expectations for treatment? What do you expect to happen?
I was all in. Like, I was all in the first time I went to treatment, but I didn't realize the consequences of all in. This time, I knew, like, I'm going to lose everything. Like, I have adult children. I'm a foster mom. I have a husband. Like, my family would never disown me, but I'm going to lose my husband. Like, I need to get sober. I can't live like this anymore. That was it. I could not do it anymore. I couldn't live with the guilt and shame and the wreckage of my past. I couldn't live with it anymore.
Yeah. Again, we hear that refrain over and over again. Were you aware? How aware were you, I should say, that you had no alternative? Did you worry that if you didn't make this work, the treatment, that you would die? Were you aware of that?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I knew. And honestly, like, it wasn't, I'm very vocal with my husband about recovery, and he's very involved in my recovery, and still to this day goes to the outpatient program for spouses where I went to treatment. He's very involved. But I knew it wasn't my fear of losing him, because the fear of losing my kids, all of that, I mean, that never mattered before. I knew to drink or to take a pill, I would die. Mm-hmm. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There was no turning back. My relapse escalated so quickly this last time that it was, I knew I was going to die, and I didn't want to die. I didn't. I had a taste of what a good life could be like without alcohol and drugs. I just needed to do the work.
Mm. You know, that retreat and you know, all reputable treatment facilities will acknowledge how critical it is to have the family involved in this process. Mm-hmm. And you say your husband finally, you know, bought into this, that you all needed this.
Yes.
How critical was that towards your success?
Oh, immensely. I will not minimize how much him understanding the disease and the recovery process that has contributed, and I probably don't tell him enough, 150% to my recovery. I don't know how people do it that live with people who drink or alcoholic people. There's all different situations. I am blessed that my husband doesn't enable me and doesn't coddle me, but he gets it. Like, if I tell him I am feeling antsy, I need to get to a meeting, or you need to get away from me, I am going crazy right now, he understands.
Yeah.
And he knows. Yeah. But he also knows and will tell me, done. The next time this happens, we are done. I cannot do this anymore. Yeah, he has boundaries and I have boundaries.
Well, that's what was lacking, I guess. Fran Pfeffer is our guest. She's 3 years sober now and taking us through that process. We have another segment with Fran, so stick around. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back, everybody. We've been listening to Fran Pfeffer. Fran has another harrowing tale of struggling with the disease of alcoholism in Fran's case. Struggled for many, many years with alcohol, twice in treatment, most recently at retreat, and now she's celebrating 3 years of sobriety. So, Fran, when you get to retreat your second time in treatment, your attitude is different. You know the stakes are higher. Your husband has pretty much told you this has got to work, and he's very supportive of this. What were your days like in retreat? Did you apply yourself more? Were you consciously aware that you had to work harder? What was going on in your mind?
I was. Everything in retreat was about me. Like, I mean, I had a life outside retreat. I had a job. I had a family. I had kids. But while I was in retreat, I strictly focused on myself. I had one of the most amazing, the best, in my opinion, counselors and the support.
Yeah. Oh, did we lose you?
All night. It was about me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, a lot of people hearing that go, yeah, it's always been about you people. You're always either doing drugs or it's important. It's important. No, but it is absolutely critical that you focus on yourself, right?
Yes. Exactly.
So let's talk about sobriety now. It's 3 years. I can tell from, you know, just your voice that you got a better outlook on things. But here's a question I think a lot of people who don't understand this disease wonder for people that are in, you know, recovery. Is it hard? Is being sober for someone like you a difficult thing?
Oh, that's a tough question. It is. It is hard. You know, I'm not going to play the woe is me card like, oh, well, you know, at least you're not an alcoholic and an addict. You can drink. I mean, but yes, it is hard. But it is, I have a life now in recovery that I never ever could have had being the person that I was before. Recovery is hard. for me, I'm very busy. Right now, I'm a foster mom, and I have a sibling group of four. It's very hard to get to meetings as much as I would like, but it is imperative for me to go to meetings, talk to my sponsor, because living the way I was living was harder.
Yeah.
It is. It's hard. And it's work.
Yeah, well, you know what? Here's why I asked the question. I asked the question because there's a danger in thinking, I would guess, that sobriety is easy because you could backslide very quickly, right?
Absolutely. And I've seen it happen. I mean, I'm sure in the business you're in, you've seen it or heard it too. There's so many people that you know, it doesn't stick, and it didn't stick with me the first time, and God willing, it will stick this time. I cannot go back to living that way, and I know the consequences. And I also know alcohol and pills are not my solution anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like I, you know, go for a bike ride, or I go for a walk, or I download a book on my Kindle and just like immerse myself in reading for 2 days straight. Like I cannot let myself get to that point where I think that a drink or a pill is going to make me feel better.
Yeah, so sobriety is not easy for someone who has this disease, but certain things are worth the struggle, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How would you characterize your confidence level that you're going to remain sober? You feel good about that?
I do. I do feel good because of my maintenance and because of my support system and because of the tools that I have. But don't confuse that with, I mean, I rarely say I'm never going to drink again.
Right.
I'm
not
going to take a pill. Exactly.
You're not cocky.
You know, exactly. Like I know how quickly it is to go back down that it's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line. The way I was living, it was a nightmare. And when my friend dropped me off at retreat on August 29, 2014, he looked at me and said, "The nightmare is over." And that is what I think about every time I think things are getting so bad. If only I could make myself feel better. I never want to go back to that nightmare again.
Fran, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it. We wish you continued success. And I know as a member of the Retreat Alumni Group now, we may have you back on again sometime. I hope so. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. Everybody enjoy the weekend, and please look for us Saturdays here on Recovery Radio.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.